Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 188.MA0106, certificate number 22095, Carob.
So in the olden days, the jewelers of Jerusalem, they would use these seeds to weigh their gold and their diamonds. 14 carob seed is 14 carat.
Krista, why are you doing this to me?
Well, John, I've been a Patreon supporter of the Omnibus, and as such, my washing bear status has given me the privilege of recommending shows in the past.
Yes.
All of my shows, and you and Ken have done three of them.
Plus, oh.
Plus there was one I got in for my sister-in-law. All have something in common, and that is they explore something that I remember from being a kid or young adult, but did not understand. So here are my shows leading up to this point. Streaking.
Okay. Right on.
The President's Physical Fitness Test.
Right on. So I did Streaking and Ken did the President's Physical Fitness Test.
And Whole Earth Catalog, which I think you did.
I did.
All things that I remember, but when I think about them, I think, what was that?
And what was the one you got in for your sister-in-law?
The Eggnog Riots of West Point.
Which was a...
It was a Christmas episode.
It was. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So now we've established in our pre-show conversation available on Patreon that you and I are effectively the same age, although I'm sure you're much younger than I am within the space of a year because of how youthful and vigorous you seem.
I think I'm older, actually.
But we both graduated from high school in 1986.
Yes.
But the things that you mentioned, Streaking, the Whole Earth Catalog.
President's Physical Fitness Test.
And the President's Physical Fitness Test were all our very Gen X things.
Yes.
And they also were things that were part of my world, and I didn't know what any of them were either. So you've done us a great service by helping us learn about our own selves, right? Our bodies and ourselves.
That's
another
right.
thing that I didn't fully understand.
Another Gen X thing.
Yeah. You're from Minnesota. We talked about this a little bit, but you and I both grew up in what? Liberal metropolises.
Yeah. I think that's fair to say.
Right? Seattle and Minneapolis and its environs they were liberal then, although now I think this is also true of Minneapolis. They were blue collar liberal.
Yes. Yep.
So they were manufacturing towns, they were working towns,
farmers,
union towns,
yep.
and farmers.
My relatives were Democratic Farm Labor Party ride or die.
And you live in Oakland, which also is a Democratic working class stronghold.
Yep, we've got the Port of Oakland here.
So we're not some kind of ivory tower Democrats.
No.
We've
no.
got calluses, dirt under our fingernails.
That's right.
And yet, even we were not immune to hippies.
That's right. That's right. Did you, when you were growing up in Anchorage, were there health food stores?
Yes.
What were they like? What do you remember? What do you remember about health food stores?
Well, they were dark and crowded. Mm-hmm. And they smelled like tea.
Yes, like tea and like rancid cumin in a bin.
Yes,
in a bulk bin.
There was a rancidness to them. And there was a kind of just a, that was the thing about hippies. There was so, there were so many smells that you didn't ask for. But also walking around one of those crunchy stores, it felt like there was nothing to a kid. There was nothing appealing anywhere. There didn't seem to be a single thing you could eat in those places.
For me, and my parents weren't interested in health foods, but my grandmother was. She spent a lot of her life on a farm, was very, she could repair a lawnmower and sew a wedding dress and do everything in between. But she was very curious and open-minded, and she was interested in health and health food. And so I think I went into health food stores with her, but they would have this alternate universe rack that looked like candy bars.
Yeah. Oh my God.
They weren't candy bars.
I know. You're just triggering me so hard. And I think anybody our age is, even seeing the title of this episode, I told some people about the show. I was like, oh yeah, I'm doing a show today. And yeah, it's commonplace for my friends to say, oh, what's the show about? Not that they care. But I said, Carob, and got the exact same reaction from everyone my age, which was a look of horror. Yeah. They didn't have to say, what's that? Or they didn't even have to think about it. It was just the word itself just triggered this this immediate, like, why are you doing this to me? So Omnibus has covered a lot of the the fads of the mid-century, a lot of the psychology, a lot of the psychological trends, and a lot of the panic of the mid-century, the feeling that the world was coming to an end. But when did this start?
So I'm going to suggest we start in a place very appropriate for Omnibus, which is the Andrew Jackson administration.
Okay. Take it all the way back. I'm here for it.
Okay. So the first, if we're going to talk about Carob, we're going to talk about health food. We're going to talk about health food. We're going to talk about popular health movements that have happened. Several of them have happened in the history of the United States. And the first one really came out of this period of the 19th century that people refer to as Jacksonian democracy. Popular, you know, populist, the elevation of the common man.
The
idea, yeah, the idea that it's anti-elitist, anti-institutional, anti-authoritarian. I would say it's the first, but not the last, kind of you're not the boss of me era of America.
Right.
And this coincided with another omnibus chestnut, which is the Second Great Awakening, which is when anyone in Western Massachusetts or upstate New York could hang out a shingle and say they have a religion. And so many new religions, communities, movements, spiritual movements were happening at this time as well. Mm-hmm. And so, one of the popular beliefs that kind of intersected in these two was the idea that, and there was a pamphlet that was very popular called Every Man is His Own Doctor.
Wow, that sounds very familiar.
Doesn't it sound familiar?
Was that put out by the NHS this spring?
Yep. And people weren't wrong to fear doctors because at that point we didn't understand germ theory. They were still using leeches. They were still bleeding people. Like going to the doctor was not a pleasant experience.
Yeah.
But can I read a quote? Because this stunned me when I read this. So see if this sounds familiar. The movement succeeded in ending almost all government regulation of healthcare. During the first two decades of the 19th century, states had regularly enacted licensing legislation. By 1845, only three states still licensed medical doctors.
Wow. I mean, because this gets to the heart not only of health and religion, but of, yeah, different ideas of what government power should be and different ideas about what government responsibility is.
Yeah. And the personal authority of every man to decide his own path. And so this influenced health and it influenced how people ate. So there is a guy named William Alcott, who was an educator, and he was the first, he wrote the first book on vegetarianism.
Oh.
In the 1800s.
Vegetarianism was already a popular way of living in the East.
It was very unusual in the United States in that, like, when you were, I think the remedy at the time for cholera was drink port and eat meat.
Yeah.
Yeah. William Alcott was a vegetarian, not because cholesterol is bad for you or that we're concerned about animal welfare. He believed that eating flesh was stimulating. And when I mean stimulating, I don't mean it wakes you up. I mean it
makes you horny.
Arouses lust. Yes.
Yeah.
So meat, coffee, tea, spices, condiments were all things that got between you and God.
Well, how much would you say that all of the reform movements of the 19th century and 20th century are just about combating horniness?
Yes, definitely all of, yes, so many of them, and also about the bowels. I would say there's an equal concern with both sides.
You don't want to be horny and you do want to poop.
Yes.
And that seems to be the secret. And so many of us are horny and don't poop enough or the right way. And that's the world is off kilter.
Yeah. So this was their concern, is that, you know, a flesh-based diet was associated with sins of the flesh.
Associated in any kind of other tradition or just kind of out of this man's mental loins?
Yeah, out of this man's mental loins, but a lot of people followed him and a lot of people were starting to say the same thing. It seemed like a lot of the reformers of this age wanted people to be extremely uncomfortable and unhappy in order to be better Christians and
the
pure.
Hair shirt.
Pure. There was also, you know, there's so much talk of purity. I think there was a, you know, like a good amount of white supremacy in there as well. Sylvester Graham was a follower, or came after William Alcott. He had a difficult childhood. His parents died. He was raised by a relative who ran a tavern. So as a little kid, he saw a lot of alcoholism. And he was very influenced by Alcott with vegetarianism, but he was also a temperance preacher. So we've got the temperance movement and the health movement,
right?
Very closely together. So he was not just about kind of removing these things from the diet, but he thought that if you ate the right kind of things, you would be more, you would prevent impure thoughts. And he thought that bread needed to be improved, especially. We needed to eat better bread.
Because we were eating horny bread before? What did the bread lack?
We're eating, again, he wasn't wrong. These guys sometimes had a kernel of the truth. At that time, there were no food safety standards. And so people who made bread kind of at a large scale would put in things like chalk and plaster of Paris and alum
bugs.
And things to make it whiter and look better and kind of hide the mildew and the spoilage. So bread, like, wasn't that good. They also used brewer's yeast, which was associated with beer. And for somebody who was into temperance, that was a no-no. So he wrote in 1837 this treatise on bread and bread making and said that you need to make this special kind of flour called Graham flour.
This was himself. Graham that wrote this or Alcott?
This was Graham.
Graham cracker.
And Graham flour was very, it used the whole grain, something we know is good today. It was very coarse. He introduced Graham flour, Graham bread, and eventually, as you can probably guess, the Graham cracker. So these Graham crackers we were eating as Gen X kids, they were, you know, they were tamping down our lust.
That explains so much. In fact, I didn't even have lust until I stopped eating graham crackers. I didn't realize there was a connection.
Yeah.
Are graham crackers good for you? I always thought of them as a cookie.
No, not the way they got mass produced. So by the end of the 1800s, Graham had sold graham crackers, graham flours to National Biscuit Company, Nabisco. They were one of the first mass produced products. The graham crackers that we eat are nothing like the graham, you know, wafers or flours. And the next person that came along, you've already talked about, which is John Harvey Kellogg, an actual doctor, finally, Seventh-day Adventist. So one of the religions that came out of the Second Great Awakening. He actually sort of understood germ theory. He was a little bit ahead of his time in terms of understanding the like presence of bacteria in the digestive system was good. And of course he founded the sanatorium in Battle Creek, Michigan. He was a vegetarian for the same reasons: no alcohol, no tobacco, bland food, and food that invalids in his hospital could chew. And so the flakes, hence, were something that people who were recovering could eat. And
soggy flakes.
Yes. So it was actually his brother who took his idea and ran with it in terms of mass marketing. Oh. And there's probably a whole omnibus episode just to put it on the list on the feud between the two Kellogg brothers. Unfortunately, John Harvey Kellogg spent most of the last part of his life promoting eugenics and racial segregation. So we're going to
isn't that the 20th century for you in a nutshell?
Cancel cornflakes.
Hey, it's Grant the manager again. How are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm good. Enjoying this nice summer day here in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, I love the way that you are taking such a hands-on approach to management.
It's my only approach, John.
Uh-huh. Very hands-on. But I can tell from looking at you here, Grant, that although you're a very handsome guy, you're wearing a t-shirt.
I am a t-shirt. I know. I always, I come to the bunker, do the addenda show. I'm there other times to meet with you, and I always feel like I need to step my game up, John.
Well, I'll tell you a nice thing. Now that the Northwest is getting so much hotter than it once did, I'd like to introduce you to linen fabrics. They're cool. They breathe. They wrinkle in a very pleasing way.
Nice.
And, typically you think of a linen shirt or linen pants as being kind of a luxury fabric, maybe inaccessibly expensive.
Yeah, totally. I do.
But I'm gonna hook you up today with Quince.
Yeah. Tell me more.
Well, Quince absolutely has high quality essentials. They like a whole section of menswear that feels and looks amazing. Organic cottons, linens, but without the luxury markup, Grant.
I'm in. Don't look chopped.
Thing. Don't be unk. Don't look chopped. Mm. But I know, as someone who hails from the North Country, that you guys pinch a penny until it screams. It is okay to tease Norwegians and Danes and Swedes.
It's 100%, yes.
For being a little bit frugal.
Yep.
But Quince can put you, my t-shirt wearing friend, into linen pants and shirts, perfect for the warm weather, starting at just $34.
That's a steal.
I bet you that t-shirt cost $34 or more.
You know it did.
But they also have t-shirts, soft, easy to wear, lightweight cotton sweaters for those summer nights where the temperature drops a little bit. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar name brands that you would find in a store or even online because they work directly with ethical factories. They cut out the middleman, so you're paying for the quality, but not the brand markup. Also, Grant, Quince isn't just clothing. They have lot of clothing for all genders, but they also have upholstered sofas, ceramic cookware, premium bedding. It's the kind of brand you end up recommending to everyone that you know for everything, just as I'm doing now.
I'm heading there soon.
So here's what I want you to do, Grant. And the next time I see you, I want you to have elevated your summer wardrobe. Although you're my manager, I can't boss you around, but I'm saying I want this for you. Yeah, go to quince.com/omnibus. That's quince.com/omnibus for free shipping with 365-day returns. Grant, that's, yeah. Can you repeat that back to me?
Oh, yeah, I can. Quince.com/omnibus.
Spell it.
Oh, quince.com/omnibus.
That's right. Free shipping, 365-day returns. Thanks, Quince.
You know, these men had crazy ideas to us, but also they were on to some problems in terms of people's health wasn't good, and people were eating too much meat, and the quality of food was sketchy, and doctors didn't always know what they were doing. They had a solution that was so filtered through their culture and through their belief system. So the next popular health movement, if we can jump forward in time, we're going to jump forward to Southern California in the 1920s.
Oh.
Okay. So
yeah,
now,
so it was the dawn of Southern California.
Yeah. The dawn of exactly. Now we've had some scientific progress. And so we understand the idea of germ theory of we understand calories now as a measure of energy from food. Hollywood in the 1920s. Consumer culture, image rather than religion and morality, beauty, consumer culture telling you all the ways you should be dissatisfied with yourself so that you would buy products making yourself more beautiful, right? This is what we're in. And so we're in a period that focuses on slimness. And so the frenzy of the 1920s was called reducing.
Is this the first instance where slimness is introduced as attractive?
I think it is. I mean,
everyone before that, a sign of wealth and prosperity would be plumpness.
Yes. Huh. So this quote from a newspaper, reducing has become a national pastime, a craze, a national fanaticism, a frenzy. That's in 1925. One of the first women to graduate from UCLA Medical School was Lulu Hunt Peters. And she wrote a book that was the best-selling nonfiction book in 1924 and 1925 called Diet and Health with a Key to the Calories.
I love that you adopted a mid-Atlantic accent, just maybe even unconsciously there, but diet and health.
The key to the calories. So this is, I'll continue this for Lulu Hunt Peters. Peters says in her book this should be the voice of from Singing in the Rain, the elocution teacher, round tones, Miss Lamont, round tones. Hereafter, you're going to eat calories of food. Instead of saying one slice of bread or a piece of pie, you will say 100 calories of bread, 350 calories of pie. And so she instructs everyone to think in terms of their eating in terms of calories.
Wow.
And years later, as an 11-year-old, I would buy the woman doctor's diet for teenage girls with a calorie index in the back. And John, if you and I were sitting in the same classroom in middle school, you would have been drawing B-52 bombers and tanks in the margin of your notebooks, right? And I would have been making lists of the calories that I had eaten that day and working out what else I could eat
make
my calorie count. So thank you,
Lou. What a nightmare.
Inducted into diet culture. And this was also a time when besides just the calories, there were a lot of fad diets because, of course, the 20s were a time of fads. So there was the 18-day Hollywood grapefruit diet endorsed by Ethel Barrymore. Cigarette diet promoted by Lucky Strike. For a Lucky instead of a sweet.
Healthy.
Yeah, exactly. Which a lot of people of our generation did, right? They smoked instead of ate.
We did. Smoking instead of eating was for sure a vibe.
Yeah. It's not. It works.
Were you a smoker?
No.
Mm-mm. You seem like a teetotaler. Yeah. You seem like a Kellogg.
Goody two shoes, theater kid. So California also had the reputation of having sunshine and fruit and vegetables and produce. And we were able to like put that produce in a refrigerated train car and ship it other places. And so fresh produce, and people understanding that like, that's good for you and you can get that in California is also part of it. And so there were these early health influencers in California that were writing at that time about raw diets or fruit and vegetable diets. There was Paul Bragg, who opened the first health food stores in California, who was selling apple cider vinegar. This is the same apple cider vinegar you can buy if you go to like a supermarket and buy Bragg apple cider vinegar. That's the guy.
And people do use that as a health food even now.
They still do. Yeah. So this has persisted since the 20s. He gave lectures on longevity. This was the other thing, is that there was thinness, but then for men there was vitality, longevity. You know, started to introduce the idea of live forever, be young forever. And so this is where we first meet the star of our story, Carib.
Carib's a person?
Carib is not a person, but it is the star of our story. It's a tree.
Oh, I see. Okay. A carib is a tree. That checks out. If you had just said like John Carib, I would have rolled over and died because I always thought carib was some kind of brown bean.
It's a brown bean, but we are going to anthropomorphize it for this moment.
Okay. All right.
So these raw food proponents and these sort of food influencers in the 20s, they were in Southern California, where there were these carob trees, which I'll talk about why in a moment. And so they started including them in their cookbooks and saying, oh, it kind of tastes like chocolate. And this has been used, you know, for a long time for carob, for sweetener. So if you want to be healthy, try carob. And that's kind of where the first mention of carob comes from, long before the hippies.
Had it been used for a long time?
It had. Oh, so let's talk about what carob is. Serotonia siliqua, for our Latin-speaking listeners. It's an evergreen tree that grows all around the Mediterranean. It's also a legume. There aren't very many legumes that grow on trees, but there are these trees that grow these gnarly brown pods, and inside the pods are seeds. It's been cultivated since the ancient times. There are tomb paintings in Egypt of people tending to carob trees. It was used as livestock feed quite a bit, the pods.
They're pretty. They're attractive trees. They're kind of gnarled and squirrely.
Yep. They provide good shade. It is commonly known as the locust tree or St. John's bread. So in the Bible, when it's mentioned that John the Baptist subsisted on locusts and wild honey, I always thought that meant he was eating like fistfuls of grasshoppers covered with
that too.
Honey. Yeah, right? Locust is another word for carob in the ancient world. And so he was chewing on carob pods. He wasn't eating grasshoppers.
Is this the thing where it was translated from from like Sumerian or whatever and it was a bad translation?
Boy, yeah, I don't know, but the connection between St. John the Baptist and carob trees is so strong that the word for a carob tree in Germany, I believe, is Johannesbrot.
Wow. John's bread.
John's bread. Yeah.
Looking at them, they do not look anything. They look like big, hard slugs.
Yeah. So when you open up one of those pods, there's two things in the pods. There's seeds and goo.
There's goo?
There's goo. And that's what's sweet.
You wouldn't think there was goo.
Yeah. And that's why people would chew on them to get the natural sweetness. So there's seeds and there's goo. The seeds aren't really edible, but they are used to make locust bean gum, which you will still see on ingredients of things that are creamy, like yogurt and ice cream. It's like an emulsifier. But you take the pod and you take the goo. Okay, here, you want to know how to make carob? I'll tell you how to make carob.
Do I ever?
Okay. You take the pod, take out the seeds. Now you've got the pod with some goo.
Okay.
You soak the pod. Then you dry the pod. Then you roast the pod. Then you grind up the pod and the goo into a very fine powder. And that's carob powder, which looks like cocoa powder.
So now, when you, first of all, when you soak the pod, do you take the goo out?
Or no,
do you
leave the whole thing. So just
you take the gooey pod, soak it, dry it.
Dry it.
Roast it.
Roast it.
Grind it.
Mm-hmm.
And the goo and the pod become one.
Yes. And that's why people say that carob, one of the reasons people like carob is because it actually has a little bit of natural fiber in it from the pod. But carob made its way to America because this tree is not native to California. But the USDA in the 1800s somehow got a whole bunch of carob trees from Spain and shipped them to the railroad stations in California to plant around the railroad stations. And then they shipped more of these to Southern Californians and said, hey, plant carob. It's going to be a great cash crop in Southern California, this new place that we are moving to.
This was the USDA in a clear example of government overreach.
Yes.
What was the idea around the train stations? Just because it was a big leafy tree that would cool off?
Big leafy evergreen tree. And also it grows well in a Mediterranean climate. It doesn't need a lot of water. It does really well in heat.
It's kind of like the starling. Some ding-a-ling was in Spain and had a bright idea and was like, I know. And then it reverberated across the eras. Unbelievable.
And so suddenly Southern California is flush with carob trees and lots of marketing telling people plant carob. And some people did. They said it would make great livestock feed. They said that the seeds are going to be great for this emulsifier thing that you can get, this thickener. A place in Alhambra, California, El Molino Kitchens, was the first place to seem to market carob as a chocolate substitute. So they were growing carob and they were marketing it and saying, El Molino Kitchens has produced a candy bar of unusual, tasty goodness. This enchanting new flavor resembling chocolate will satisfy the sweet tooth we all occasionally have for confections. And so that's sort of the first mention of carob similar to chocolate. But it really didn't take hold until the counterculture food movement, which is the next popular health movement that happened. But it didn't really catch on even in the 20s because carob trees were quickly overshadowed as a cash crop by citrus.
Oh, right. I'd much rather have an orange.
And that takes a lot more water.
Oh, yeah.
See also Water Wars entry.
Right.
Right. And so carob, it kind of fizzled out because there were oranges and lemons and grapefruits and those were.
Oh, my.
Yeah. But then the hippies came along, fast forward, and their belief system, like all of these belief systems, influenced their food. So hippies, they were interested in turning their back on mainstream culture. they were interested in getting back to the land, living off the grid, intentional self-sufficient communities. They were interested in environmentalism and animal rights. And they were fascinated with the practices of Asian cultures, meditation and yoga and Eastern spirituality. And so all of those jumbled together in a hippie stew that tasted terrible.
Right. The vegetarianism of Buddhism,
the
half understood.
Yes. Yeah. The macrobiotic diet, which is basically, I think, like, here's what Buddhist monks eat when they're begging for food. So the macrobiotic diet spread by George Asawa, who came over from Japan, gained a lot of ground with the counterculture movement. May I read you a recipe from the macrobiotic community cookbook from 1972?
Yes, this is interesting because as you were saying before, there are a lot of these things that we grew up with that I never fully understood. And I had no idea what a macrobiotic diet was until you just mentioned it. It's something that I heard a million times, but I just Googled it. And it is inextricably connected to Zen Buddhism.
Yeah.
And in fact, is based on balancing yin and yang. I thought macrobiotic diets had something to do with
science.
Macrobiotics.
Yes, both of those words sound like sciencey words.
They really do, and it seems like if you combine them both, it's like, oh, it's got to do with bugs in your gut but it's about balancing yin and yang.
Yeah.
Okay, go on.
So, if you'd like to make this for dinner tonight, this is a macrobiotic pizza. Now, macrobiotic diet has no dairy and no nightshades, so there's no tomatoes. So you're gonna make a dough out of just wheat flour, salt, and water. There's no yeast in it, so this is basically like how you make Play-Doh
flatbread, right? This is unleavened. Yeah.
Then you're gonna take some onions and carrots and oil and water, and you're gonna saute those and then pressure cook them until they just are soft in the water. So you're gonna sort of, you know, cook down some carrots and onions. So then you're gonna make a sauce with the water left over from cooking the vegetables. You're gonna add miso and tahini to the carrots and onions. Okay. So now you're gonna put that sauce on the dough. And you're going to chop up some little dried fish. And you're going to put the fish over the carrot sauce on the dough. And you're going to bake it at 400 degrees for 30 minutes. And the recipe finishes by saying, this is a real treat. So despite the fact that hippie food is absolutely terrible, so much of it is still with us. Yogurt, granola, kale, tofu, quinoa, just organic produce, whole grains, like it stuck. And it made its way into the mainstream. The vegetarian cookbooks got more mainstream. The vegetarian epicure, the Moosewood cookbook, these are probably all books that we might have seen on people's bookshelves. And what mostly brought health food from the hippie communes into the suburban houses we grew up in was something called Prevention Magazine. Do you remember magazines? You remember magazines?
I remember them all too well, but I even remember Prevention Magazine.
And I have a couple of Prevention Magazines from 1979. So this
very
period.
Those are old. Yeah, I remember Prevention Magazine after it kind of glossed itself up a little bit.
Yep.
But it always felt like old people stuff.
Oh, yeah. My grandmother, who was into health food, was a religious reader of Prevention Magazine. She was always dropping knowledge like, eat your potato skins because that's where all the nutrients are. You know,
that's right. That's where all the nutrients are. That should be on their flag.
Yeah.
Oh no, don't throw away the gross part. That's where all the nutrients
are. That's where all the nutrients are. So Prevention Magazine was just eminently sensible. It was not very woo. Like the articles were about wearing sunscreen and calcium building bones. And it sort of took health food to mainstream, middle class, sensible. I want, you know, we're not eating to save the planet. We're eating to not have a heart attack.
Right.
And this magazine, so People magazine had 2.4 million subscribers in 1980. Prevention magazine had about 2 million subscribers at about the same time.
Wow.
So it was a big magazine. A lot of people were reading this magazine. And in this magazine, people would have seen articles about the wonder of carob. This was the time when people really brought back carob. So imagine we're back in like 1981 and, I don't know what Journey's on the radio and, there's an Atari in the living room.
Foreigner 4 is out by then.
Lean Cuisine is in the freezer. Lean Cuisine just came out and a well-meaning, suburban mom picks up a copy of Prevention magazine and reads about carob. It's got natural sugar, so there's no need to add sugar. It's got vitamins and minerals right in it.
Those are two things you want.
Yep. It's got calcium. It has three times the calcium of chocolate, John.
And I was already eating chocolate just for the calcium.
That's right. It doesn't have the substance that gives some people migraines from chocolate.
I didn't know that people got migraines from chocolate, yep. But now and I do.
At the time, it was believed that chocolate caused acne.
I vaguely remember chocolate causing acne.
Yeah, people thought the chocolate caused acne. So when this suburban woman with the Moosewood cookbook on her shelf and a Women Hold Up Half the Sky poster up reads about this, she is going to run out and get some carob chips, some carob powder. She's going to get carob candy bars with puffed rice and carob covered raisins for her kids. And I sent you some so that we could do a taste test.
Okay, so here we are. I've opened your box. Mm-hmm. They are classic examples of carob bars that are absolutely trying to fake you out like they're chocolate bars.
That's right.
All right, what do you want me to eat first?
A dealer's choice.
The plain one. All right. It says here it's advertising points. It's unsweetened. It's keto friendly. No added sugar. It's vegan, caffeine-free, and gluten-free, and organic. Looks like chocolate. It breaks like chocolate. Oh, does not smell like chocolate.
No, it doesn't.
It smells chocolate adjacent, though.
Yep.
All right, here we go. Oh, what a rip. Bah! Yeah.
So this is what people said about their memories of carob when I asked them. My strongest memory was that whenever I took a bite, I had the expectation that it would be chocolate deliciousness, but instead I was biting into brown paraffin. It tasted like the kind of chocolate you'd get if you were being punished. My dad remarried a Mormon woman in the 80s and all the chocolate disappeared from our house and was replaced with carob. Another person said, I took a hippie health food baking class. We didn't use sugar, only honey. We didn't use chocolate, only carob. Everything was yucky. My mom had a cookbook called No Sugar, No Salt, No Fat. My brother at 6 years old took a marker and wrote on the book, No Fun.
100% no fun. It tastes like feet. But you know, it has the texture mostly of chocolate. And what's interesting about the feet taste is as I was eating that chocolate bar, I was like, my mouth is going to taste like this for a week. There's no amount of apple cider vinegar I could gargle. But as it's gone, as it dissipates, it also is just sort of, the aftertaste isn't as strong and awful as I might expect.
It has kind of a caramely aftertaste after the initial bitterness, I think. They weren't even trying to sweeten it or make it taste good.
It says right there, no thing about this is good.
One of the biggest products for carob right now is carob for dogs.
What?
Because dog owners feel bad about eating chocolate in front of their dogs, and dogs can't eat chocolate. And so, hey, give your dog a chocolatey treat, Carob for Dogs. It's a thing.
Oh, my God.
I know. You know, Carob did go away, mostly because chocolate rebranded itself as sexy in the 80s and 90s.
Go on, tell me more.
So this is when chocoholic enters the lexicon. This is when chocolate starts to be marketed as a luxury good, but even more with, you know, advertising is getting more provocative in the 70s and 80s. And do you remember seeing like Dove bars and Cadbury and Godiva chocolate bars? And they were often in ads with nearly nude women.
Yeah. Like a pantyhosed leg with a high heel and like chocolate dripping down.
Yeah. So this is when chocolate like really, this is the nail in the Carob coffin. Not that there was any question about it. Death by Chocolate was a huge dessert. Came out in 1979. Sandra Boynton, remember the hippo lady? Chocolate, the Consuming Passion, was a New York Times bestseller. And, okay, you'll remember this. Comic strip Kathy.
Of course.
What was Kathy's problem? She ate too much chocolate.
She was a chocoholic, sure, like all of us.
Ack
is right. She was saying ack because she couldn't get the... Because Irving didn't bring her the chocolate when he came.
She tried on a swimsuit and didn't like it and went home and ate too much chocolate.
Ack.
So this is very sort of gendered, you know, women love chocolate, but they shouldn't. But you should give women chocolate because, right? It's so chocolate did just fine. And then it even started saying, hey, we're healthy in the 2000s, saying we have antioxidants.
That's true. I mean, I believe it's true because they told me.
Right. But here's the thing. So here's
dark
our
chocolate, right? Dark chocolate
is good for you, right?
It's so, better than vitamins. It's better than vegetables.
Right. But here's the epilogue. Futurelings listening to this in the far future may be subsisting entirely on Carob.
Oh, no.
And that is because
they're bugs. They're Carob locusts.
Because they're all John the Baptist.
Uh-huh.
Carob is a remarkably resilient crop and tree in a time of climate change. It doesn't need a lot of water. It's fine with a lot of heat. Its fruit doesn't spoil. It's just dry pods. Cocoa beans, beet sugar, sugar cane, all of that is already being impacted in terms of availability and prices by climate change. There was a huge to-do with Reese's couldn't get enough like chocolate in its Reese's peanut butter cups to call them milk chocolate. So they started calling them a chocolatey treat or something like that.
That happened recently?
Recently. And there was an outcry. So get used to the Carob because it may be the only food our civilization can survive on.
Is there a way to make Carob not taste terrible?
So there are chefs who use Carob in desserts and in foods. And their take is let Carob be Carob. Don't tell anyone it's chocolate. Don't make it look like chocolate. Don't try to make it taste like chocolate. Let it be its own distinct flavor, whatever that is. And so possibly our experience with this as like hearing something's going to be delicious chocolate, but it's not, may muddy the waters a bit.
And that concludes Carob. Entry 188.MA0106, certificate number 22095 in the omnibus. Futurelings, you know that in addition to all of the chocolate going away and being turned into, what did Reese's call it?
Chocolate-esque? Chocolate treat?
Chocolate treat, something like that. in addition to climate change taking away all the good things, social media has also taken away all the good things, with the exception of just a couple of places on social media where good things still reside. And those places are Omnibus Project branded social media spaces, YouTube, where you could watch this episode. You can see Krista and myself in our Gen X spaces with our Gen X glasses frames. You can go to youtube.com/@theomnibusproject. That is very awkward for me to say, slash at. I just feel like one of you technical writers has got to change the way that we do these things. Anyway, youtube.com/@theomnibusproject. You can hang out on Facebook, Reddit, Discord, Instagram. I think maybe we're gonna open a TikTok, as the kids would never say. You can email us to theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can visit our website, omnibusproject.com, and you can submit a proposal for a show to co-host, as Krista has done, at omnibusproject.com/submit. You can send physical mail, as Krista did when she sent this the worst gift box I've ever gotten. This box of 7 kinds of carob. Care of the Omnibus Project to 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084, Burien, Washington, 98166-9998. And finally, you can support this show. We encourage you to do it. It is a listener-supported program. By going to patreon.com/omnibusproject, join up at whatever level makes you the most comfortable. Krista, you were saying that you are a washing bear.
I believe that's my status.
Washing bear status. And you've supported Omnibus on Patreon for a long time?
Since the beginning of the Patreon, yes.
And you have seen one of the advantages that your shows that you proposed in the past actually Ken and I made those shows.
Absolutely. I feel like your Gen X correspondent.
Krista's living proof that being a member of our Patreon group has surprising benefits. And although there are fewer opportunities to suggest shows to us, there are more opportunities to come host a show yourselves.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.